on this edition of the program. Why does Joe Biden want to go back to COVID times and the progressive strategy that will win the election in 2024? It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Owe Them Bones, Daily Tech News Show, V, and Craig.
Welcome, everybody, to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for Friday, March 29th, 2024. Your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you from Austin, Texas. Let me play you this clip.
Predecessor and MAGA Republican Congress have a different plan. Let's remember, 4 years ago this month, we saw how my predecessor didn't care much about science and reason. During the pandemic, that went on to claim 1 million American lives. And for every life claimed, it's estimated there's between 8 and 10 people left behind. Trump didn't level with the American people. He told Americans all they had to do was inject bleach in themselves. Remember that? Not a joke. You'd think I'm making this up if you just take a real shot of UV light. Even before the pandemic, my Republican Congress were hell-bent on getting rid of the ACA. They came within one vote, but a close friend of mine, we used to argue like hell, but we spent a lot of time together over the years. But it failed because of my deceased friend John McCain going like this. But even during the deadly pandemic, Trump and his MAGA friends in Congress wanted to get rid of the ACA, kick millions of Americans off their health insurance.
That was Joe Biden revisiting the COVID-19 pandemic at a campaign rally in North Carolina this week. It was aiming at something that he's been starting to do a little bit more of, trying to counteract the nostalgia of the Trump years by highlighting their darkest days. Of course, the hope is that by recalling the 2020 pandemic and lockdowns, Biden can emphasize the Trump administration's mishandling of the crisis, something that was so unpopular, Donald Trump wasn't president by the end of that year. It's part of a deliberate effort to remind voters of chaos under Trump, something that, according to Biden 2024, America does not remember quite clearly enough. Biden's hope is that the comparison exposes Trump's mismanagement and bolsters Biden's image as the more competent leader, especially in crisis situations. But this is a risky scenario, largely because COVID-19, according to Politico, is something that his advisors worry could backfire on him. You know, it was a bit of a divisive time. Not exactly something that people want to remember very, very clearly. But despite these concerns, the Biden campaign believes it's crucial to highlight Trump's erratic behavior and lack of scientific adherence. Yes, this is a Trump bad, you know, it's like an orange man bad kind of thing, which is something that obviously is an important part of the Biden campaign. You need to run as a referendum on Trump, because they don't feel that their record is something that's going to speak for itself. But really, this is about the economy. Follow me. Joe Biden has a recovering economy, and one that has a gigantic big blue ribbon very close to being achieved. And that is a soft landing. The idea that we had a very high inflation and we will not go into a recession, something that many, including your boy, have been kind of predicting for about a year. We all got to stuff it. Now, does that mean that things are going great in the economy? No. All politics is local. My wife is out of a job, and that means, from my perspective, the economy's terrible. But by the numbers, things are good, and at the very least, not in a recession. So, why is that bad for Biden? Because right now, by the polling, He's not trusted on the economy like Trump is trusted on the economy. Indeed, when people suggest who had a better economy, Donald Trump does a lot better than Joe Biden. But wait a minute. The Biden heads cry from the White House. Didn't Donald Trump preside over an economy that very briefly but terrifyingly cosplayed as the Great Depression? Why doesn't that get factored into his permanent record? And lo, you get into the black magic that is COVID. By any stretch of the imagination, a total chaotic moment in history, not only in America, but also globally, where a lot of different leaders made a lot of different decisions. And certainly some herded more in one direction than another direction. But America's collection of decisions that were made up to and including lockdowns, not locking down enough, the development of the vaccine, the implementation of the vaccine. Well, there's a lot that went on to try to craft a coherent narrative that's going to appeal to independent voters is probably a little easier said than done. So to preserve that the economy is good now and Joe Biden gets the credit, you have to say that the economy was terrible during COVID and Trump gets the blame. And the way into that is by just bringing all of this up. There's also another side of this. Chaos. Right now, dear listener and viewer, we are in chaotic times. The world is at war. Doors are flying off planes. Ships are taking down bridges in Baltimore. It's a rare condition in this day and age to see any good news on the newspaper page. But how do you make that relate to the matters of the family, the kitchen table issues? You have to demonstrate that Joe Biden is a gift in these times. Yes, a lot of things are happening. Yes, the Afghanistan withdrawal was terrible. Yes, it's not great that Ukraine is under attack. Yes, it's terrible that both October 7th happened and the IDF is reacting in Gaza the way that they are. Yes, 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 yes. But it would be worse with Trump. You are lucky there's a steady hand on the wheel with Joe Biden. Can he effectively make that argument? Well, to do it, you have to show the biggest crisis that Donald Trump faced. COVID. Something that, again, America has already decided once he did not do a good enough job with to retain his position. But of course, that brings us back to this. What kind of makes using COVID as a political issue a bit of a Kobayashi Maru? Who the hell wants to think about 2020 and 2021? Not me. It's a very, very, very frustrating year to think about. It is among when I was the most depressed. It was when I was the most frustrated. So if you're asking people to revisit a time in which there is for real PTSD, when folks are contemplating exactly how much their life changed, when so many people moved, when you've got real loss of learning, and we are just seeing those effects now. Kids that were in middle school are now looking to graduate high school. And they're not better for the time that they spent outside of the school. I mean, at least study after study has shown that. And by the way, if we're going to talk records during the lockdowns, then you got to go back to the positions that Joe Biden held. Part of the reason why we might hit this soft landing is because the economy did continue to run more than Democrats might have wanted it to. Harsher lockdowns, more mandates were what they were calling for. Indeed, it's the backbone of Trump mishandling that time. Of course, Trump also gets attacked by the right for developing the vaccine or having acquiescence to any lockdowns whatsoever, but that's not currently where the attack is coming from. One of the things that I've always wondered if Trump is galaxy brained enough to use is to float the idea that the COVID pandemic was kind of the reason for January 6th. Is to be like, hey, we all did stuff that we're not proud of. So is this smart? I don't know. In my opinion, I think it is a chance. It is a roll of the dice. At its worst, it's an idea that sounds a lot better when you're in the room than when you actually put the candidate out there on the campaign trail. But it does belay that right now, if your strategy is to define Trump and have America come out on the other side of it thinking negatively, that that's not working. We haven't seen take what you want, take off. We haven't seen bloodbath take off. So now you got to go play the greatest hits. Now it's shine UV light up your butt and inject bleach. But is that old news? There's the old political adage. If you're explaining, you're losing. This is your update. Brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's where you can support this show. It's where you get two bonus episodes each and every week. Go ahead, sign up. $3 level. You get not only all the episodes, so four episodes a week covering all the politics that you can possibly handle, but now video versions of each and every one. Head on over there. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. selected tech attorney and entrepreneur Nicole Shanahan as his running mate for his independent presidential bid this week, emphasizing Shanahan's fresh perspective and commitment to tackling chronic disease, corruption, and technological issues in government. Shanahan's significant financial contributions to Kennedy's campaign and related super PACs total $4.5 million, and that's hard to ignore. With no prior political experience, however, Shanahan's appointment marks a bold move for the Kennedy campaign, aiming to collect national ballot access signatures in addition to states and addresses pressing national health concerns. Shanahan's involvement in political and philanthropic endeavors reflects her deep commitment to public health, technological advancement, and social justice, despite controversies including reported ties to Elon Musk and her divorce from Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Shanahan remains focused on her nonprofit work and advocacy against toxins and electromagnetic pollution. I watched all of Shanahan's speech. I broke down every second of it. It is up on the YouTube right now, youtube.com/@politics, politics, politics. Top line thoughts. It was very much her first political speech. She sounded like she was a keynote speaker at a conference and not leading a political rally. But I do think there's some upsides, mostly because she's got the ability. She moved around in a lot of Democratic donor circles for a while, and she is not shy about talking about it in the speech. She was a big donor for Biden. She was a big donor for Mayor Pete. But she said she left the Democratic Party because she was tired of the conversations that were happening in those rooms. If there is anybody that has a unique ability, especially to that very skeptical audience, to talk about what the conversations are in the rooms where it happens. She is. She can make headlines that way. Here's the other thing. She's got a bit of a colorful romantic history. Married to Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google, had a child with him. And then allegedly, while she was separated from Brin, according to a Wall Street Journal article, had an affair with the one, the only, Elon Musk. Boy, that man's social calendar can be busy at times. Does she want to talk about that? Probably not. Will it get brought up about her by Democratic operatives that want nothing more than for both her and RFK Jr. to fall into some sort of black hole from which they never emerge? Yes. It's free publicity. And if there's one thing that RFK, the OG, and JFK knew, it is that all publicity that you can get can be used to your advantage. The more you work the weaknesses of our modern media structure, the more you can direct people to you. And in our diffuse political world, where somebody getting something brought up about you, for every one person that's going to call you a name for the rest of the cycle, they probably weren't going to vote for you anyway. There's somebody that's just curious and winds up going to your YouTube page and hearing your message directly from your mouth. Do I think that this is a big deal? Probably not. In fact, that is most cynical. It's a donor saying, you know, I should lead your VP search. Robert, I found your vice president. And it was in the mirror the whole time. The abrupt termination of Ronna McDaniel's contract with NBC mere days after her debut on Meet the Press sparked controversy and potential financial repercussions for the network. McDaniel, the former RNC chair, anticipates a full payout of her two-year $600,000 contract, which she argues was terminated without breach on her part, effectively making her brief appearance cost NBC over $30,000 per minute. Hey, at least I got to cover it on the PX3 Extra, huh? Further complicating matters, McDaniel, advised by high-profile lawyer Brian Friedman, is exploring legal avenues, including potential defamation and hostile work environment claims following harsh criticism from MSNBC's top talent, who, by the way, didn't just say it. They said it on air as content. The fallout reveals internal disarray within NBC as executives and top talent, including MSNBC president Rashida Jones and Meet the Press host Kirsten Welker, seemingly flip-flopped in their support for McDaniel. Accusations of misleading conduct and lack of preemptive integration efforts by NBC brass have surfaced alongside critiques of NBC's quick capitulation to internal and external pressures. Donald Trump on the newly IPO'd Truth Social said that Ronna now finds herself in Never Never Land after she went to NBC, said everything they wanted her to say, which I assume he means criticizing January 6th and saying that violence is never appropriate. But you don't want to be there, according to Trump. She can't go home again. She can't go to the mainstream liberal media. So where does she go? Just kidding. Probably Fox. But will she do it now? Probably not. That's going to be a huge Trump rally position. Of course, you could always come on the PX3 show, Ronna. Ronna, we got a home for you. Personally, I think this is weak and pathetic by NBC. Just absolutely spineless. When your token conservative who's got stories, again, talk about being in the room where it happened. She's been in those rooms. She will tell you she was already doing interviews with conservative outlets where she was talking openly and honestly about the failures of the party in 2020 and 2022. Like, this was, she was on Front Street about it. She probably would have been more on Front Street about it on NBC. And they can't handle a Romney. They can't handle a Romney. They didn't bring on Steve Bannon. They didn't bring on Seb Gorka. They didn't bring on Vivek Ramaswamy. They brought on a Romney. A Romney. They spit it out like an infant. Just sad. Sad by NBC. And the bosses, look, I don't know what kind of student revolution, student cultural revolution is happening inside the Slack channels of NBC. But when you, as the leaders of that network, can't step up and say, knock it off. Anybody who doesn't like it, hit the door. Anybody on air that wants to bitch about it, you want to be Keith Olbermann? You just want to be yelling on Twitter, sad and alone with your cats? You want to do that? You can go ahead. Take the Olbermann exit. Feel free. Trust me, plenty of young, fresh-faced liberal icons that would love these time slots. We'll have Ben Collins in primetime tomorrow. You want to talk like that. But no, no. They capitulated. They folded like a cheap card table. Democratic candidate Marilyn Land's victory in Alabama's State House District 10 special election represents another sign that reproductive rights is an effective turnout method for Democrats. Land's, a professional counselor, defeated Teddy Powell, a local council member in a race spotlighted for its focus on abortion and in vitro fertilization issues. This election followed a tumultuous period in Alabama, where IVF services were briefly halted due to a state Supreme Court ruling that classified frozen embryos were children. Subsequent legislative actions to mitigate civil and criminal liabilities for IVF providers rekindled the debate around reproductive health care rights, propelling Lands to leverage these concerns effectively throughout her campaign. Lands's win in the district, known for its unique political composition situated within a predominantly conservative state, underscores the electorate's response to restrictive reproductive policies. Her victory sends a clear mandate for the repeal of the state's stringent abortion laws and the protection of IVF and contraception rights. We're going to do this interview that you're going to hear with a knot. I've said it once. I've said it 1,000 times. The Democrats, women's health, women's health, women's health, women's health, women's rights, women's health, women's health, women's rights. That's it. Talk about that. Best way to win. Because until the Republicans come up with a coherent answer to it, which right now is non-existent, shields are down, baby. Hit the exhaust port. Blow up the Death Star. That is your update. TakePoliticsSeriously.com is where you need to go if you want more of this show. $3. If you would pay me a cup of coffee, sit there in the car with you, talk about politics, or sit face to face if you're watching me. Well, then it's the deal of the century, especially during an election year. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Our guest today is a progressive campaign strategist and the host of Words to Win By, a podcast for which you can find the third season available everywhere that you find podcasts. Welcome back to the show, Anat Shenker Osorio.
Thank you so much. It's great to see you again.
So a lot has changed. I think I had you on probably 2 years ago leading into the 2022 election cycle. It seems like things have really only become more intense, specifically in the progressive space, which is a part of a coalition with the Democratic president in power going for re-election, but obviously a lot of turmoil there. So let me just start here. What are the issues that animate progressive voters the most in 2024?
That's a great question. So what I would say, and here I really want to disaggregate, there are the issues that folks respond to in survey, and then there are the issues that actually work to mobilize.
And that actually get people to the polls, which is contrary to popular belief, the way you win elections.
Yeah. So that confuses a lot of people because we see a lot of opinion research. I personally conduct tons of opinion research. We see it, you know, publicized frequently from ABC News, from Pew, from, you know, Gallup, et cetera. And this idea that the news is made out of what people think the news is seems to be kind of de rigueur, by which I mean, instead of telling us what's going on, the media is now dedicated to telling us what people think about what's going on, which is its own separate conversation we can have some other time. Oh my God,
I could talk about this for about 11 years. This is whenever we get into journalism rigor. But please, let's move on with your specialty.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't forget the question. Just, you know, one can go into a cul-de-sac very easily. So, what people report, and I want to underscore what people report, because, you know, listeners will be like, I've seen the polling. People say that what they care about, what's going to mobilize them, is a whole host of economic issues. Well,
yes,
that is not a shocker, right? People also like back rubs and free lunches. I don't know why we need to keep asking people, what is your top issue? It will ever and always be the economy as they reported in polling.
Yes.
However, the way that a person responds to a survey, especially a survey conducted a year out, 11 months out, 10 months out before an election, and what actually causes someone to make a decision to go to the ballot box in the first place, and then, you know, which specific choice they make once in that booth or once dropping off that ballot, that's actually quite different to how they respond to a survey. So, easy response on the first one. What do people say is motivating them? They say, on average, in the aggregate, results vary by subgroup, but, you know, some confluence of economic issues. We've monetized human existence. Not a shock. People are concerned about making ends meet. What we see actually mobilizes people, as we can see through field experiments, as we can see through past elections, as we can see through things like the way that Democrats have overperformed relative to prediction and to history and to polling in the last few elections since really 2016, 2017, since Trump came into the presidency, is that they're motivated by a feeling that they need to protect their freedoms, that they're motivated by stepping into what my colleague Mike Podhorzer calls being the anti-MAGA majority. So when people really understand this election, and we see this over and over again in our qualitative, but also in more sophisticated forms of research, when we shift people's mindset away from this election being a contest between two candidates or three or four, depending on, you know, how deep
what your polling is. Yeah.
Yeah. Away from seeing it as a contest between two asterisk plus individuals towards two conflicting futures, they are way more engaged, way more interested, way more likely to either register a plan to get involved or to actually take some form of action of getting involved, by which I mean, if we're doing a field experiment where we're doing peer-to-peer texting and we're actually making them click on a link to register to vote, that's not a self-reported, yes, this gets me. That's an actual action.
Yes. That is, you know, we often talk on the show about the kind of X's and O's and blocking and tackling of winning campaigns. This is that, you know, this is the kind of less than glamorous actual thing that needs to go on in the field. If you want to win, is identify the voters that you are most likely to get into the booth, make sure that they are registered, make sure they get their ballot, and make sure that their ballot either goes in absentee or on election day, all of which have their own strategies. So you mentioned that the anti-MAGA majority, the idea that a Democratic or progressive voters feel that there are things being taken away and that is going to motivate them. If we are going to rank those freedoms that would be taken away, number one, I'm implying from that this is a more domestic perspective as opposed to a foreign policy perspective, by the way that you initially framed it. And I would imagine, unless there was something else there, that the number one freedom would be women's health. Is that mistaken?
It's not only not mistaken, it's not only spot on. What's interesting about abortion is that it serves both in its own right as a really, you know, clear and salient threat, a really clear and solid point of differentiation. Again, going back to that earlier conversation, people are never going to say abortion is my top issue, because that is not putting food on the table every single day. But what we see is that abortion is a perfect example of an issue where if you make that the terrain of the fight, if you make it so that people understand the election to be a contest around that issue, then people show up. Because it also allows you to really differentiate yourself from the other side, whereas, you know, where you stand on the economy, what happens with the economy is kind of this muddled mess that has very little to do with what actually happens in the world and much more to do with people's perception. Abortion isn't only an extraordinarily mobilizing issue in its own right, as we've seen in ballot initiative and special elections. Mm-hmm. It's also what we call a salient exemplar of the rest of the right-wing agenda. So it is what took voters out of the "you're just Chicken Little, the sky is falling" perennially every cycle. You say they're going to do this and they're going to do that. So when we use the Dobbs decision as an anchor point, and I'll tell you what that sounds like in actual messaging in a moment, it makes more credible the rest of the story that we are, I would argue, accurately telling. So when we tell folks, for example, the very same MAGA Republicans who took away your freedom to decide whether and when to have kids, that very deliberate phrase, whether and when to have kids, mm-hmm. because that includes contraception, sex ed, IVF, et cetera, now want to take away your freedom to pick your own leaders, to retire in dignity, to be able to put food on the table, weaving in those economic questions as well. Not that abortion doesn't have an economic component. It absolutely does. All of reproductive and family planning and family formation is very much economic. But it lets us draw that bridge from here's this thing you know they did, and that is just the tip of the spear of the rest of the plan.
So this is very, very, you know, I think clear based on what we have seen over the last several elections. And it is a specifically effective strategy, I think, on the left, because not only is it the exact clarion call that you are spelling out, but you're walking into a divided opposition. I don't think that there is any question that the Republican Party writ large is the dog that caught the car on this. You had elements of their coalition that were very, very animated by it, but now they don't have a central thing to rally around. In elections past, you could fight over Roe versus Wade in this very binary way that actually melded coalitions together. And now really only one side has it, and it's the left. The right can't decide exactly where to go with the future on this. And that, in terms of getting people out there, making sure that the things that you need to do, which again, identifying voters, registering voters, getting ballots in their hand, making sure that they deliver them, is a huge tool, right?
Yeah. And what's interesting, I mean, I don't know if you mean to lean all the way into this, but here I go. One of the interesting asymmetries, just at a linguistic level, if I can sort of take myself out of the feelings, so that's what I'm doing as an analyst momentarily.
Yes.
Is that the right-wing storyline around abortion has historically provided a role for the audience. So within their storyline, they have said to people, you, direct address, you join us and you save babies.
Yes.
And you save women from this invented post-abortion syndrome. You will be the hero. And again, historically, what the left had in their kind of traditional pro-choice messaging was the directive to the audience, to the listener, to do nothing, right? Your job is get the hell out. Don't have an opinion. Don't do anything. You know, this is someone else's choice and it's really not about you. And just in terms of rhetorical strategy, what we find is that, and it's very facile, but it's true, when you want people to do something, you have to cast them as an agent in the story.
Yes.
Because action begets action. It creates social proof. It creates the sense that the thing that I am doing is meaningful and will help lead to change. So now, using your dog that caught the car, now the right is kind of in multiple binds, but the bind that I'm talking about is the narrative one, where what are they kind of, you know, they're still trying to get more lemon juice out of the lemon by still, you know, with the Supreme Court Mifepristol case, for example, they're still trying to kind of rally people up under this guise that they are doing this noble, heroic thing of, quote unquote, saving people or proto people. But it's a little hard to sort of still get that going because the feeling is like, well, we kind of got this thing. And like you said, it's very muddled. Whereas on the left, suddenly there's a huge audience role. There's a huge, you can be the one to ensure that someone you love can get the care they need. You can ensure that whomever the person is, they're able to decide for themselves. You can be part of this movement to restore this most fundamental freedom. And that's a really powerful thing.
You know, it's a rare element, especially in a cultural issue like abortion is, for the left to be on the side of comforting, nostalgic solution. And that's exactly where they find themselves. It's why I've said repeatedly on this show that women's health, and I do think that it should be cast as wide as that net, should be the number one thing that Joe Biden should wake up, say it three times, say it four times in the afternoon, and then a few times before he goes to sleep at night, because that is, there's a lot of chaos. The Republicans have not settled. They're not close to settling on where they want to go with this issue. You saw a lot of sliding through the primaries of evangelical candidates falling off the stage the fastest, which is something that normally did not happen, especially when you had Iowa, which is a tremendously evangelical state. You've got the standard bearer and likely nominee who's managed to avoid talking about the issue throughout the entire primary process. So nobody knows. It is a continually spinning roulette wheel. And meanwhile, the Democrats should have the number one issue. Wasn't it nice when it was settled? Look at who picked this scab. It was not us. We would like to now solve it based on the lines that we had it before. And that is clear. So let me ask you this. And has it surprised you that the Biden 2024 campaign has not leaned into it as hard as I think some people have expected?
I wish I could say it surprised me. that's what I would love to say. But no, and I think there's two kind of big categories of reason it doesn't surprise me. The first is the one that I'm guessing engendered your laugh, which is, you know, it's very challenging for this White House to stick the landing. So they will grab onto something. You saw it, for example, in most of the parts. There's one sort of critical piece in the middle of the State of the Union that I really think was way off, but the outset and the ending of being a fighter, of being pugilistic, of being, hey, here's what we're up against. Let's just name a spade a spade. It's authoritarianism. We see it in Putin. We see it here in this very chamber, these very people that I'm addressing right now. Awkward, are part of, you know, having tried to overthrow this very government, you know, kind of a sticky spot to be delivering a State of the Union. But here I am. I'm not going to make believe that this is just a normal report where I like deliver some graphs about the size of the economy.
Yeah.
So in those moments, you know, the marching with UAW, first president to be on like a picket line while he was in office. Those are the moments, the dark Brandon moments, that don't just get him kind of flashes of social media notoriety. They actually register a notable uptick in research among voters being like, oh, yeah, like, yeah, that's, you know, if you want to draw people to your cause, you have to be attractive. And being attractive like a magnet means you have a polarity. It means you draw people to you. It also means you will repel people because you are making a clear distinction. I think that as a creature of the Senate, as a person who has, you know, a very long career in politics and a career that was built in a very different time where bipartisanship was its own reward, I think that, you know, it's sort of like neither fish nor fowl. On Monday, it's one thing, on Tuesday, it's another. And so it doesn't surprise me in the sense that, you know, I think there's some discomfort with just being like, here's what the F is up and we're going to just like call it what it is. That happens sometimes and it doesn't others. But the other reason why, the deeper reason why it doesn't surprise me, and this is, you know, just to offer full candor, a real challenge for us, and we see it, we're in weekly focus group, 2 to 4 focus groups a week with various configurations of what we call disaffected Dems, swing voters. We sometimes just think of them as the no-nos. So no Trump, no Biden, which are like the nut we most need to crack, our no-nos.
Double haters is the term that I have seen become term of art recently.
Yeah. I just like calling them the no-nos because it's
I like that one better, to be totally honest with you, and I'll be using it going forward.
It's kind of a fun thing to say. Among these no-nos, which, you know, we've been talking to in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Nevada, Arizona, we're about to go to Georgia, all the places you would guess. For the more news consuming ones among them, and even among the lower information who kind of just like catch the vibe, a thing that they say back to us, and it's hard to dispute, it's really uncomfortable when focus group participants tell you just the truth, because what do you do then? It's very inconvenient. They say, you know, this stuff happened on Democrats' watch.
Yeah.
Like, Democrats were in power and this happened. And that is both when they are speaking about these abortion bans, about Dobbs, when they are speaking about voting rights and all of the restrictions, you know, for folks in Arizona and Georgia in particular, for example. Like, they're very acutely aware that they had to, especially if they're Black voters, wait in line for umpteen hours. And they know it. They experienced it. You can't sort of like erase that from their memory. That's very visceral. Yeah. And so they keep saying over and over to us, who's going to protect us from these things? They told us last time around that we were supposed to vote for Democrats to protect our freedoms, and we did. And that doesn't seem to have actually yielded. And so when you're telling us this time around that we need to do the same thing, kind of where's the credibility in that? And so I think that the challenge, ironically, for making abortion and voting rights, and I would tag team those two things, because they are both about the most cornerstone and fundamental freedoms, the corporeal, your body freedom, and the decision making, you know, how are we going to decide all future decisions freedom that really, really matter to people. You have to not just be able to sell that, but you have to be able to sell yourself as a credible solution on that. And when that feels desirable, the thing that the voter wants, but not credible, the thing that the voter doesn't think you're going to deliver, that's when you get yourself into a spot.
It's part of the reason why I was very critical on this show about the phrasing "restore Roe" in Biden's big $30 million kind of debut ad that ran during March Madness, a gigantic captive audience. But part of, you know, one of his strengths is that he is stability. He has been in Washington forever. He is the steady hand on the wheel. It's what got him elected in 2020. But on the other hand, if you're literally saying something that sounds like restore Roe, sounds like defend Roe, I mean, I just feel like there's a way that you can make this more present and less in the past, because it is a very, very, very present issue for voters, and terming it as a thing that was the best, even if codifying Roe is your solution, although I have some questions about the math on how you get to 60 votes in the Senate, if we're going to get into the exact stuff of that. But like, it's surprising to me that there's not a more present message there. There's not a more, here's what we're going to do, and here's why we're going to do it, and here's how we're going to get it done, either in terms of actually doing something currently as the president, or what you're going to do going forward. It just it feels like a loaded gun there for the campaign that they have not yet figured out how to pick up.
Yeah, I think this is where I come back again to two things we're seeing. One I mentioned and we'll circle back to and how it manifests here. The other, a little bit more direct. When we engage in conversations or when we try messaging that says Trump is, so you can fill in that blank in, yeah, you know, a thousand different ways. Trump is a criminal. Trump is corrupt. Trump is racist. Trump is, you know, take your pick.
Go ahead. Search. Season to taste.
Yeah. What happens with voters, especially these disaffected voters, these double haters, is they rejoin with Biden is. And usually the way that they complete that sentence is Biden is old. Biden is, you know, incompetent. Biden is whatever, a creature of, you know, the Senate. Like, Biden is the status quo and we don't like the status quo. When you say Trump is and you fill in a characteristic, the meta message that you are sending is that you should think about this election again as a contest between two people. And you should evaluate them on the basis of their personal characteristics. And while I would argue that any kind of rational thinking person would make that evaluation and have a very, very, very clear outcome, because regardless of his faults, you know, the Trump is Biden is comparison to me is obviously Biden is, you know, a bazillion times superior for, you know, just having not committed a criminal conspiracy to try to overthrow the election, that small distinction between them. Mm-hmm. We are better off if we are forced into a Trump v. Biden kind of rhetoric saying Trump will do. Because when you say Trump will do and you fill that in, people default to Biden will do. And that may feel like stasis, and they may not love that because they don't love where they're at necessarily, but it doesn't feel sort of actively dangerous or, you know, a taking away of even more. When you can, going back to where we started, having a conversation about the candidates is largely useless to us. And I think here I was really struck last week. One of my colleagues attended a briefing from an international consortium of folks who have been fighting authoritarianism on their own front. And there were folks from Poland who presented. And for listeners who don't know, they had election somewhat recently, and they managed to get rid of their own right-wing authoritarian who had done all sorts of things, not least of them, you know, ban abortion and do all sorts of nasty things to women's rights. And a core thing that they said to people, which is very much akin to what I've been saying, is that they would say to voters, vote for the Poland you want, not the person you want.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And that is where we are much better off when we ask people to vote for the America they want and not the president that they want.
So maybe centering the entire campaign on clips of rallies of your opponent might not be the way to globalize that thought.
What's interesting about that, and I'm still trying to unpack this, but in some of the deeper research that some of my colleagues have conducted, full Trump videos perform less well than a still clip image of him with the quotation. There's something about, I mean, you know, it's ironic. I won't name what the ad is, but there's an ad that is quite long that, you know, has Trump saying all of his blathery, terrible things. And it's basically saying to the listener, do you want to listen to four more years of this?
Yes.
And the irony is that the first task of a political ad, the first task of any ad, you know, you're selling shoes, you're selling software, whatever.
Yeah.
You have to make people watch the ad.
Yes.
Because even in sort of addressable TV, people can open another tab, look at their phone, like, you know, just distract themselves. Tune out. And then with a lot of ads, you can actually just skip over them, right?
Yeah.
So the first task of the ad is that the person has to view it. And the irony is that that ad is made out of, here's a thing you don't want to watch. And it turns out it has very low video completion rates. So their hypothesis around the ad is spot on,
yes,
and therefore renders it an extraordinarily ineffective ad. So clips of Trump, you know, the viewer has to get to the end of the story if the story is going to work. And so you have to think about that in the ad creation.
Yeah, I have great misgivings about the strategy, mostly because, number one, we've already seen it fail once when Donald Trump was a insurgent with the party out of power in 2016. It works in 2020, but there's so many lessons of 2020 that I think just kind of need to be thrown out because the pandemic and the lockdown and the economy were so abnormal. We were in such a very weird place. I think many of us would like to forget large swaths of 20 and 21 just in general because of where our lives were, that I don't know. But the only thing that we should take from 2020 is it was a very close election. This will be a very close election because of political polarization. So you should fight for every vote, which brings me to this. You are somebody that is out there talking to the no-nos, the double haters. Something that has been talked a lot about in terms of demographic shifting is an increasing number of specifically Black and Hispanic men, as well as Asians of both genders, voting more conservative or being more open to Donald Trump. Now, I have seen professionals in the world of politics be very skeptical about some of the percentages, both on the conservative and the liberal side. Where do you stand? Is this movement real? And if it is it the 20-30% that we have seen in some of the polling?
Yeah. So, you know, the classic sort of experiment where eyewitnesses are asked to describe a suspect. And
yes,
if they're like a little tiny woman, they'll say he was very tall. And if they're a very big man, they'll say he was very short. And if they're African-American, they'll say he was light skinned. And if they're white, they will say he's dark skinned. Everything is in the eye of the beholder. Why am I saying this to you? I'm saying this to you because the way that those studies are conducted, and if you kind of read underneath, in order to say that something has increased or decreased, you have to have an anchor point. Mm-hmm. And when they take as their anchor point, as they frequently do, Democratic performance under Barack Obama, then everything has decreased.
Yes.
Because the singularity that is Barack Obama as a figure, both because of what he represents as a category, but also just who he is, you know, how he is as an orator, a singular kind of charismatic figure that we don't see a lot in the world.
Yeah.
Right. So for many, 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 many reasons, the political participation, especially among voters of color and within that Black voters, you know, even to a higher degree in 2008, was unparalleled and unprecedented. If you go back and you look at a lot of these newer things that are coming out, you know, yelling and screaming about loss of voter share, they often anchor back to 2008.
Gotcha.
Instead of anchoring back, for example, to 2016, if you anchor back to 2016, Biden in 2020 did as well, if not better, with a lot of these groups than Hillary Clinton did. So, you know, is that the anchor point?
Yeah.
And then when you extrapolate out to today, you can't make a comparison, as you've already rightly suggested, between what happens in elections and what happens in polling. Because again, what we see over and over again is the way that people respond to a survey question this far out from an election of would you do this or would you do that is more or less them registering a displeasure with the status quo. It's basically, you know, I don't like how things are, so I'm going to say no to this. The question then becomes, when it's not a survey and it's an actual ballot to cast, however you cast a ballot. So, you know, is there an issue? Is there something going on? Should we be worried about it? Look, I'm worried about everything. I'm a Jew, right? It's anti-Semitic to ask me not to worry. Like, worry is how I live. Is it this kind of giant phenomenon that is the topic du jour and the kind of whipping post for Democrats among centrist pundits right now, I'm skeptical. And the last thing that I would say, the more important thing about this question is embedded within raising this as a thing that's going on, how much it's going on, how concerning it is the implied solution and sometimes the articulated solution. And what a lot of the folks who are raising this up are saying is this is because Democrats have become too woke and now
too far left.
Yes. Too far left. And now even it's impacting Latinos, it's impacting AAPI folks, it's impacting Black voters. That's the part where I would say we go from like curious use of numbers to just absolute unrepentant bullshit and no evidence. And if anything, very much evidence to the contrary.
Well, I'll tell you what, we are about over our time, but I'm shocked that we haven't gotten here. This conversation has been so great. So I'm going to have to ask you for, we mentioned before domestic issues. That is the pathway forward. That is what you have seen. That is the stickiest, but obviously the biggest division between the Democratic coalition right now between progressives and centrists is on foreign policy, specifically Gaza. How much do you think that not now, but in November, that division plays into our final vote share? And obviously I'm asking you to do a little, fortune telling here, as we have no idea what the state of that region is going to be several months from now.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say before I answer this question is that I work in politics because I actually care about people's lives. I care about outcomes. For me, it's not just this kind of game of winning so that the person with the D behind their name can be in office. To me, that's meaningless unless the policies enacted by the people who are in office are pro-social, pro-justice, pro, you know, a better life for everyone. And so the question around Gaza and Israel, I think, is much more meaningful in the immediate term around what ought to really be happening. And I think it's very, very challenging for any person of conscience to not recognize the absolute destruction and decimation that's going on. And I would add that as an Israeli, which is a fun twist because I am, the Israeli public, by and large, finds Netanyahu repugnant, and it's really difficult not to. He is a criminal. He is corrupt. Were it not for this war and this aggression, he would be in prison, which is where he rightly belongs. And so any action that the U.S. government is taking to help prop up this person is really not dissimilar to a giant profusion of foreign governments helping prop up Trump. We would be disgusted, and Israelis understandably want Netanyahu gone. So I needed to say that piece.
Yes.
Now back to the like strategy and politics and all of that. I think it's a very meaningful issue because regardless of the size of the voting cohort that it impacts, it's not so much about the how many, it's the who. And that's what people forget. In a lot of these states, obviously, Michigan is the one that comes top of mind. But people, you know, don't discount Minnesota. It was within 10,000 plus minus votes of going to Donald Trump in 2016. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of it as reliably blue. It's a purple state. There's also a significant Arab American population in Georgia, et cetera. It's not just that those folks exist, and not just Arab Americans, but folks who are understandably really, really upset about what's going on. It's that those are the folks who tend to also be our door knockers, our drive people to the polls, our, you know, get the word out. And so when you're upsetting your choir, it doesn't really matter if you have a giant mega church with like 2 million adherents. If the choir is the reason people come because the choir sings really beautifully and suddenly the choir is like, I quit, you're going to have problems at your mega church, even if it's 10 people. So it really is very important. The way it's in that we've seen, absent an actual policy solution, which is the actual solution, is again, going up to this meta level and reminding folks that, and this isn't just true about Gaza, it's also true about immigration, it's also in the border, it's also true about people feeling like we're not getting as much economic advancement or tackling of inequality as we would like. reminding folks that the only ways we've ever gotten progressive change in this country, the Civil Rights Amendment, women voting, ADA, marriage equality, the 8-hour workday, you fill in any of those, has never actually been through voting. We have never gotten those progressive advances via an election. And so voting is an essential tool in our arsenal, and it is the way that we select who responds to the other kinds of demands that we make. Voting is a choice about whether the person in office is going to let you yell in his face. I'm saying his because that's probably what's going to happen. It's going to be a he. Yeah. Yell in his face when you disagree with him. Are you going to be able to march and strike and protest and demand better wages, for example, or be able to join a labor union? Or will you be thrown into the gulag for daring to voice something in opposition to the government? So I really think what I shorthand as this vote, strike, march message, we've seen some inroads in that. And it's a way that folks, especially younger voters, voters of color, who are rightly and understandably very upset about policy choices happening, can understand why you still need to get out and vote, and you need to vote for Democrats and Biden, because, again, change doesn't come through the electoral system exclusively. It requires the electoral system in order to be able to agitate in these other ways.
I think very, very, very well put. Indeed, I might say Words to Win By, which is, of course, the podcast by our guest, Annette Schenker Osorio. Thank you so much for coming on. And we definitely need to have you on at least a few more times before this election, because there is a real clarity from your perspective, and the thing that we tend to spend the most time talking about, a lot of the actual reality beyond rhetoric of, you know, securing victories in these contests. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, 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 written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to thank our guest, Annette Schenker Osorio, well, you can head to px3guest.com. Find and share clips of this show. TikTok is Justin R. Young. Instagram is Justin R. Young. You can find my personal Twitter at Justin R. Young. PX3 Tweets is the show's account on Twitter. And on YouTube, we got everything, man. We got our videos, our live stream archives. It's all there. Politics, Politics, Politics on YouTube. We're trying to build that up. So tell a friend. TheYoungAmerican at gmail.com is where you email into the show. If you prefer Twitch, which is where the majority of our live chat is during our live streams, it is px3live.com. Find and share the show with anybody that you know. Friends, family, clergy, px3podcast.com. If you like anything that we've done this week, any of the commentary, any of the guests we've had on this week, and you just want to say attaboy, you just want to say, man, you want to know what? Good job. I just want to let you know you're doing a good job. Podcasting's a lonely profession. I just sit here and talk in my spare guest room into a camera and a microphone, and I hope and I assume people are hearing it, but it's a real message in a bottle situation. If you want to let me know things are going good, hit me off with a little one-time donation, huh? PayPal.me/payjury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can send anything you'd like to me in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Again, that is Post Office Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Now, there's only one way to get bonus episodes, and that is by heading to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news we missed on our free podcasting schedule. And our $10 tier gets your name right at the end of the show like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Including Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, and vote Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Brian, Edison, Jeremy, A Dog Named Checker, Sarah Genie, Spider, Matthew, Dr. G, Dustin, Brad, D. Laser, Nick Wood, Just Another Pilot, Middle-Aged Mike, Utah Jimmy Montana, The Jet, Halo, D. Really, Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, D. Vaughn, The CFP, Gloria Young, My Mom, Grayzone, Peepaw, Jay, Neil, John, DP4 Bongo, Neil, His Nerdiness Charles, Audrey Stole Adler Spot, Darren, Idris Arslanian, Berkeley, Steven, Nematic Terran, Molly's Delightful Demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, and Paul, if you want your name read on the show. Guys, come on. Only one place to do it. Take politics seriously.com. And that's it for the week. Hopefully you guys had a really, really good time. I know I did. Until next time. I don't know who we have on the show. We haven't booked anybody for next week. But it'll be good people. It'll be good people. This is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss. Oh.
Three. Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.